Today on Against the Grain, our food system, as well as our ecosystems, is clearly in crisis. Should we look to technological fixes and lab-grown meat to provide food for our future? Or, as writer Teres Gresko argues, should we look backwards instead to the lost foods of our past? Gresko argues that a sustainable future necessitates cultivating food and plant diversity while reclaiming collective practices, including those drawn from contemporary indigenous peoples. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Over our half-million-year existence, humans have consumed a wide range of foods, but that's changed. In The Lost Supper, Searching for the Future of Food in the Flavors of the Past, award-winning writer Teres Gresko set out to explore foods that have been forgotten while delving into the question of what sort of food system could sustain us into the future. Along the way, he explores foods ranging from ancient Roman fish sauce to insects to farmhouse cheese. His many books include Bottom Feeder and Strap Hanger, Saving Our Cities and Ourselves from the Automobile. When I spoke with Teres Gresko, I began by asking him, to what degree is the diversity of the foods we eat diminishing, and what's driving that shrinking biodiversity?
Yeah, it's a giant problem. It's one I grapple with right from the start in the book. We had a rather large variety of diversity of foods that we ate in our sort of hunter-gatherer days. When you look at the range of foods that hunter-gatherers eat, it's incredible. You know, often in some prehistoric sites, there are dozens, hundreds of different species being consumed. We're at the point now, well, there's a couple of things going on. There's an extinction crisis going on, so a loss of biodiversity, but there's also kind of this lesser known agro-biodiversity loss happening. So according to some estimates, a quarter of the 8.7 million known plant and animal species that are alive today are going to become extinct over the next few decades. So that's the sort of, you know, the red alert that we're all experiencing in terms of habitat loss leading to plant and animal species biodiversity decline. But there's the agrobiodiversity decline that's happening too. And according to the FAO, about one-tenth of the 8,800 or so breeds of domesticated animals that have been used in agriculture over our history, you know, all the different breeds of pigs and sheep and cows, they're already extinct. And every month, a half dozen more are lost forever. And the same thing is happening with traditional crop varieties. It's really hard to know how many different crop varieties we had in the past, but the best estimates I've heard, like since about 1900, we've lost about three quarters of the genetic diversity of things like grains and fruits and vegetables that we had in the fields. So it's a huge loss. And, you know, my inspiration for this book was sort of going into the past to look at the diversity of the past, because really, if you look at it now, we're getting 60% of our calories from just three species of grass, corn and wheat and rice. And, you know, those are subject to scientific hybridization and genetic modification. So it seems when you go into like a Trader Joe or a Whole Foods that there's all of these foods available from all around the world. The reality, I mean, it can seem like compared to what you might have found in your parents or grandparents supermarkets, wow, we're drawing from all these sort of trade and food webs. If you drill down though, the actual genetic diversity in what we're eating is really limited. I mean, just for dairy cattle, I think 90% of the milk in the United States comes from, you know, this one breed of cow, the freakishly productive Holstein Friesian. And those all come from just two bulls. It's crazy. Same, you know, same happens with pigs, that kind of thing. So, I mean, the whole idea behind this book is diversity is resiliency. And by diminishing the genetic diversity, in our diets and our farms, we're losing resiliency in the system.
Well, what about things like produce? Now, as you mentioned, if you go into many supermarkets, particularly those that serve people who are middle class, that there seems to be a great range of things, things that even a few years ago weren't on the shelves. Would you say that even so, we're still experiencing greatly diminished biodiversity or agrodiversity in terms of what we eat? Or does this also range depending on how much income someone has for buying food in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, you go into the high-end supermarkets, and of course you're getting, you know, your kale and your quinoa, your amaranth and your spelt. That's available. But in reality, very few people are eating those things. As a matter of fact, I think in the years around the pandemic, the number of undernourished people in the world increased by 150 million. The statistics are rather dire. And we're heading up to a population of, say, 9.8 billion by mid-century. And the latest estimates are we're going to have to produce 50% more calories to feed all the people on the planet. So everything is kind of pushing us down to like greater economies of scale, longer supply chains. And it's very worrisome because our only backup plan, really, the only effective one, is putting some of this diversity in gene banks in cold storage. And, you know, hoping we can access it in the future. Whereas in reality, what we have to be doing is taking these things out of the gene banks, keeping them alive in the fields and the farms, and, you know, and encouraging farmers, like ethical farmers, to produce these things. It's really hard to balance all of this, of course, you know, with, you know, because in a lot of cases, these things tend to be more expensive. Going to a farmer's market is, you know, you're paying more money. It's sort of seen as a bourgeois, you know, or an upper class habit. My argument is that actually reconnecting with some of the fundamentals of food production can bring down your food costs as a household. The problem is a lot of people just don't have the time. Time is a luxury. But my voyage in this book was just to, you know, reconnect with sort of the history of our relationship with food during our 300,000 or so years as a species to make some kind of sense of what's going on now. Because everything is pointing to reduced diversity. And we're getting these sort of what I call techno mirages. It's like, we're going to feed the, we were going to feed the world with lab grown meat. Well, that's turning out to be a total farce. I mean, there was a great article in the Sunday New York Times just saying, you know, there are billions of dollars been poured into this and they haven't produced anything that's edible. George Monbiot, the British environmental journalist, who I have a lot of respect for in some areas, believes, because he is very, very heavily vegetarian, he believes that we should not be doing agriculture at all. He thinks that agriculture writ large is a bad idea. And his solution is to for the world to be fed on protein pancakes, which are synthesized from yeast from some lab in Finland. I'm a big skeptic of these sort of eco-modernist solutions. I think that a lot of the solutions actually lie in sustainable and traditional practices from the past. And a lot of those come from indigenous communities, which is what I really discovered, which was really interesting in my travels.
And we'll talk as we go about the sort of threads that you find hopeful in terms of thinking differently about how we produce food. But I wanted to ask you specifically about this notion, which undergirds a lot of the debates around food, that agriculture, the emergence of agriculture, was really kind of the original sin in our history. And there's a sort of primitivist version of that argument. And as you mentioned, George Monbiot, the journalist, has one version of it. The controversial geographer Jared Diamond has another. But basically that by moving from being hunter-gatherers to settled agriculture, that was the moment of the fall. And since then, we've been in great trouble. There are others like the anthropologist David Graeber who push back against this idea that settled agriculture was
the sort of source of all of our ills. How do you understand that? Because obviously these debates around the past have everything to do with the future, as you are yourself saying, in saying, yes, we need to recuperate things from the past to be able to live sustainably here on out.
I find that whole discourse very, almost biblical. I mean, it's a fall from grace kind of thing. There's another person who's put this forth, Richard Manning, who wrote a book called Against the Grain, and which kind of romanticizes the hunter-gatherer existence. Jared Diamond, as he said, puts this forth, as does Yuval Harari in Sapiens. And I've heard it echoed all over the place. David Graeber and David Wengrow and The Dawn of Everything did push back against that, and I'm really grateful to them for doing it, because the place that I went to investigate is this sort of proto-urban community called Chattahoochee. So 8,000 years ago, it was the largest settlement on Earth. I think there were 8,000 people living there at one point. And the interesting thing about Chattahoochee, which is in central Turkey in Anatolia near Konya, is that it was sort of, people were baking daily bread. They were gathering grains from the wild and eventually domesticating them. So this was like, it existed for 1,000 years. Very strange settlement with like mud houses, very tightly packed together. And you entered through the roof. They've beautifully excavated the site. So you can learn a lot about their daily practices. And one of the things they did was they baked this daily bread. One of the fun things I did in this book was kind of try to recreate all of these things at home. So I ground my own emmer wheat using a Mexican matati or grindstone, found a Turkish baker with basically a Neolithic style oven to recreate the flatbread at a restaurant, and used exactly the same spices or lack of spices to flavor the bread. It was a really interesting experiment. But the point being that, you know, grain is often blamed for enslaving us, for, you know, tying us to one place. And I think there's a big romanticization of sort of hunter-gatherer existence and a demonization of agriculture. You know, baking our daily bread led to sort of pyramids and pharaohs, stratified societies, that kind of thing. And there's a lot of evidence that there were a lot of places where hunter-gatherers were gathering to bake bread, and in some cases to brew beer in a place called Göbekli Tepe, also in what's now Turkey. Getting involved in these hierarchical societies. I mean, a lot of it goes back to what we think we know about ancient Egypt, which was a very beer and bread-based society. So yeah, of course, agriculture blamed for being the original sin. I understand where this comes from. It's because we've been through three agricultural revolutions, the Neolithic, the industrial starting around 1700, and the Green Revolution in 1960. And by now, agriculture is heavily industrialized. You know, it's full of chemicals and genetic modification. And it's made a mess of the planet. So people are coming from a very good place. They're looking around and saying, oh my gosh, the soil is depleted. We've relied too heavily on synthetic fertilizers. We can see the end coming. It's all the fault of agriculture. I'm making the case that it's not. And, you know, that it's really important. My strategy was to get to know, it's always been, to get to know the producers and the farmers who are trying to do it right, who are trying to use regenerative agriculture, who are trying to bring back the health of the soil, who have mixed farms, multi-species farms. It's not new. I mean, you're in Berkeley, Michael Pollan's been writing about this for years, but it's interesting to dig back deep into the history of our relationship with food to see how this all worked out. And I just can't stand this idea that the solution, this techno-solution, is that we're all heading to this ultimate loss of biodiversity, of diversity in diet and flavor, some kind of protein pancake, some form of soylent that will nourish the billions and make everything equitable that way. I don't think that's the way the world works. I'm pretty sure we're not going to be eating that stuff in the future.
Terrence Gresco is my guest. He is the author of The Lost Supper, Searching for the Future of Food in the Flavors of the Past. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I wonder if you could tell us more about this place in Turkey, which translates to mound in the fork of the road, and the kind of wheat that dates to this civilization, and how it differs from the wheat that most of us consume.
It's one of the ancient grains. The one that was found on the site most commonly is called emmer. It's a hulled wheat, which means that you have to kind of thresh it to get the nutrition. It makes it harder to work with. It's interesting, I guess, for its nutritional qualities and its flavor. For me, I was just looking for authenticity. I wanted to experience what they were experiencing. So when I sought out emmer, it could have been einkorn, which is another relative that existed at the time. There are a lot of sort of, most of us eat standard bread wheat. There's also kamut, also known as khorasan. Wheat is, in general, is very interesting. But my whole modus operandi was to kind of look at people in the past as equivalent in ingenuity and abilities and intellect to us today in terms of problem solving. So that's why I was sort of attracted to emmer. And also I was, just trying to counter the idea that, grains were terrible for us, that grains were the source of, for a long time there, especially 4 or 5 years ago, that was being highly demonized, not only as sort of the source of hierarchical societies and bad nutrition, but just because it was, it was seen as like the thing that tied us down. And I was trying to untangle all of that by going back to the process of grinding it, as I said, with a batati. It's very instructional when you do these kind of things. It's like, I had to like get this grindstone. I worked with a baker here in Montreal where I live, and he showed me the technique for grinding these very hard grains of emmer. And it took about 5 hours to grind enough to make flatbreads for our family of four. So I did it in like 2 sessions of 2.5 hours, just going back and forth with the grindstone to produce the flour. It ended up being delicious, a really interesting flavor. I flavored it with wild mustard seeds. They found a lot of wild mustard seeds on the site at Çatalhöyük, not very much salt, and it was incredible. It was a very familiar kind of flatbread, like a chapati or a roti, puffed up. But there's something about the flavor of fresh ground grain, which is also highly nutritional. We've really removed most of the nutrition from the breads we eat now. Sourdough is a way of getting around that. But there's all kinds of studies that show that, grinding fresh ground grain produces bread that is full of more bioavailable nutrients. And another thing is just the flavor is incredible. The woman and the baker I was with and myself, we did a little dance when we ate this stuff because it was so nutty and warm. And it kind of made me realize why people like hunter-gatherers would start to consider staying put. It's like, I think flavor is very much underrated as a force in human evolution and cultural evolution. I think we, because anthropologists tend to be very sort of focused on leaders and structures and pyramids, there's been this long-term neglect of flavor. And I think, we are sensual beings, and we were interested in what things tasted like in the next valley. What is that berry like? What would happen if I added this to my ground grain? I think that there that might be one of the motives for remaining in place. I can have some fresh bread and maybe some beer.
But you mentioned the effort that it took to grind this emmer. And I guess it would lead to the question whether, well, number one, you needed to grind it with stones. What, you know, what's the benefit of doing that? And then is that a model that can be replicated on a large scale? And I guess, could you just sprout it?
No, that's true. Yeah, so if it often was moistened and sprouted, that would have been a lot easier. It raises the question about gendered activities too. Who was doing the grinding? In ancient Egypt, it was turns out to be women, and you can actually, in the skeletal remains, because you sort of kneel, the best way to do it is to get your shoulders into it, kneel down on the ground. So you'd have your toes pointing out, folded behind you, or your legs folded behind you with your toes pointing up. And in the skeletal remains, there's actually like deformations showing that the women had like toes permanently pointed upwards because of the way they were bent.
Let's talk about eating insects. There certainly are a great abundance of them relative to other species, of course, that we're in the process of decimating. Should we consider eating insects?
You know, every book is sort of an investigation of ideas, and that was one of the ambient ideas when I started the research on the book, you know, around 2018. It's like, yeah, we should all be eating bugs. They're super abundant. It makes all kinds of sense. It's a good source of protein. There are a lot of traditional societies that eat them. So I went down to Mexico City. And in Mexico, they've got a very long tradition. They found, you know, edible insects in archaeological sites going back thousands of years. And Mexico City in particular, and some other states around Mexico City, have a long tradition of eating bugs. Interestingly enough, what I found, the discourse here in the United States and Canada is, you know, it's fun, it's, you know, it'll be a cheap way to feed the masses in the future. Actually, in Mexico City, they're incredibly expensive. They're like, I went to some of the top, like, white tablecloth restaurants in the capital, and they were the most expensive things on the menu. Things like escamoles, which are the larvae of flying ants, the queen ants. They're rather large. They're kind of like little Boston baked beans with white skins, and they cook them in butter with a spice called epazote. Really delicious. But yeah, it was twice as much as any sort of main course on the menu. And the same thing goes for almost all the insects, like maguey worms, that kind of thing. So there's a culture of eating them. I'm not convinced. After all my research, I came back to Canada. I went to the largest cricket farm in the world, which is in Ontario. And they're raising crickets there in these old chicken barns. I think there are 30 million crickets in one room. And they, you know, they were good. I took my son, my oldest son. He started to like eating them. We've added them a little bit to our diet. But the reality is they're very expensive. It still costs a fortune to buy even dried crickets, which are kind of the most familiar and available form.
And why is that, given that there's so many insects in the world? Is it just a very scarce number of suppliers?
It's labor intensive. It's a lot of work. I mean, the cricket farms, they're selling them, you know, if you can buy protein powder now for 20 or 30 bucks, the same amount of ground cricket powder will cost twice that much. So, I mean, it's used by a few bodybuilders. I think it's one of these ideas that's nice in theory, but in practice, it's, you know, it doesn't work out. It remains. I started off thinking, okay, this is one of the visions of the future of food, a diet of worms, so to speak. By the year 2050, we'll all be eating bugs. I don't buy it. I mean, it was an interesting exercise to go investigate that idea. I was actually searching for a thing called a wautli, which is the eggs of a bug called the water boatman. And this goes so deep back into Mexican history. The Mexica or the Aztecs used this as a major source of protein when they arrived on Lake Texcoco, which is which used to be the sort of the dominant lake of Mexico City. So they'd gather these bugs, and you can still find it in some restaurants in Mexico City. It's a very strange. They're tiny little bugs. They almost look like pepper, and they bake them into or fry them in patties and serve them with a mole sauce. But they're quite rare now. And that's the disturbing thing I found with insects. There's a lot of, now there's, because they're so prized, there's a lot of habitat destruction that goes on. When you're gathering the escamoles, the eggs of the queen ants, they often, amateur harvesters often destroy the nests. So I think for me, insect eating was a great exercise. It really allowed me to plunge back into history, but I don't see it as the future of food in any significant way. Once again, I see things, other things I discovered in my travels as being a little more significant, other traditional, especially indigenous practices.
And just staying with the question of protein, it's obviously a great debate whether we should be eating meat at all, given the ecological impact of pasture land and of meat production. For many years, you didn't eat dairy or meat, and I wonder if you could tell us how you ended up on an island off of Georgia eating pork, and how you square your thinking now with that of the past.
Yeah, to be clear, I've never been a vegan. I guess what you call a semi-vegetarian. There's lots of different labels. I eat seafood, and fish, and I wrote a book about it called Bottom Feeder, where I went around the world looking at, you know, how to eat ethically in a world of sort of vanishing seafood. It's one of the last wild harvested foods around, but, you know, being overfished at an alarming rate, and a lot of the aquaculture isn't sustainable. I do eat meat. I eat meat if I know it's ethically raised. I know if I know the farm system that it comes from. And I'm willing to pay the price. I think we eat far too much protein. There's a sort of myth that we need, you know, hundreds of grams of protein per day. And in the United States in particular, people consume more protein than they need. My whole idea is that we should be eating less meat and treating it more as an occasional indulgence, valuing it as people do in traditional societies where their diets are mostly vegan or vegetarian or seafood based, with occasional consumption of meat. There's this unfortunate thing going on where, you know, the living standards rise in, if you want to put it that way, in the majority world, in China and India and places like that, there's more of a shift to meat and protein consumption and sort of in the Western style. So I'm very cautious about advising this, but I say, yes, eat meat if you know where your meat comes from. Ask the questions. Don't take it for granted. And in this case, I went to a dairy farm in the Yorkshire Dales to look at cheese production. And they were using a breed of critically endangered cattle called the Northern Dairy Shorthorn. So bringing it back was actually enriching the meadows around there, enriching the whole ecosystem. And in the case of the very interesting case of the Osaba Island hog, so these were a breed of pigs that were brought over by explorers and missionaries from Spain, probably from the Canary Islands, and dropped off on the mainland and barrier islands off the coast of Georgia in particular. And the Spanish would use these as kind of a living larder. They would drop a few pigs off and come back in subsequent expeditions, and of course they multiplied. The interesting things about the Osaba breed, it's the closest thing on this continent that you can get to sort of the famous pata negra ham of Spain. So this is a prized ham. The legs can sell for 600 euros a piece. It's incredibly tasty. The pigs in Spain are raised on forest mast on acorns out in the open in this landscape called the Dehesa. And what they had in the barrier islands, Osaba Island, was very similar, you know, the live oaks instead of the oak trees of Spain. And And these pigs lived there for 500 years, and over the centuries, they got smaller and smaller. It's something called insular dwarfism. And they learned to survive on salt water, to tolerate high levels of salt water. They're also eating acorns and crabs, if you can imagine. And a few, about 20 years ago, some farmers took them off the island and started to raise them on their farm. So I visited some of the farms, I visited the islands, I visited the restaurateurs in Charleston and Savannah who are serving these pigs. Once again, it's very expensive, but I was comfortable with eating it just because it's sort of the epitome of ethical meat raising, and they really do benefit any ecosystem they're in, with the possible exception of Ausubel Island, where they eat just about everything, including horseshoe crabs and things like that, and some endangered species of sea turtles. So pigs can be pretty voracious, but if, you know, in a well-managed farm system, they're actually part of, you know, returning fertility to the soil through their manure, that kind of thing. I think, you know, meat eating is part of agriculture. It's part of human history. But I don't understand all of these celebrity chefs who, you know, who go out and indiscriminately eat pork without reflecting on where it came from. Even the barbecue, the great barbecue traditions of the Southeast United States, often just it's commodity pork, you know, which is hugely polluting. So I think this can be perceived as sort of an elitist thing. You should be eating less meat and better quality. But I don't see that necessarily as elitist if you balance that with, well, for most of the time, I'm getting protein or getting my calories from a vegetarian or a fish or seafood-based diet. You know, I think that is a pretty healthy way forward, a sustainable way forward. And incidentally, you start to support the farmers who are really, the small farmers who are really struggling to return to a sustainable, regenerative, soil improving form of agriculture.
Staying with protein again for a moment at least, you write about cheese in the book. And of course, cheese is a ubiquitous food in the West and something that one can find in a wide range of forms, from artisan cheeses to squares of something processed. It seems very distantly related. How long have we humans made cheese? And why do you argue that farmhouse cheese is actually good for the planet?
Cheese is really interesting. Fermented dairy is really interesting. Once again, I started doing experiments in my own kitchen with this. There's all kinds of theories about the origins of cheese, and most of them are fall into the realm of what's called fake lore. One of them was, you know, that nomads were carrying milk around in gourds on the steppes, presumably of Europe. 5,000, 6,000 years ago, and they put liquid milk, which they were going to consume, into the gourds, but the gourds were made from the stomachs of ruminants, and they had, the rennet in it that converted the milk into delicious cheese, and voila, cheese was invented. The question being, of course, why would people who couldn't digest milk, because most people back then were lactose intolerant, why would they be carrying around liquid milk at all? It's probably more likely that, you know, in certain conditions, with certain acidity and certain temperatures, milk just turns into cheese. And observing that, it's very easy to make cheese. I've made my own ricotta and things like paneer just with adding lemon juice and heating milk. It's quite satisfying to do it, and it's actually really delicious. But cheese is, once again, like well-raised meat, is part of this complete farming system. Most of the cheese, of course, you know, the stuff that goes on top of pizzas, the stuff that we consume too much of, is industrially made from those Holstein Friesian cows. And we're not doing the planet any favor by eating it, as delicious as it might be. I really strive. I've lived in French-speaking societies for almost half my life, first in France and then in here in Quebec and Montreal. And there's a really good culture of cheese production. And you can always seek out cheese from small producers who pay a lot of attention to what they're doing. And they care about the whole farm system. They care about the fertility of the soil. So I really have no problem with eating, you know. Here in Quebec, I'll seek out this cheese called Pied de Vent, which comes from les Îles de la Madeleine, this beautiful archipelago inhabited by Acadians, but it's widely available in supermarkets around here. And it's made from the milk of Canadian cows. They were brought over by Jacques Cartier originally, one of the first explorers. And they're these small cows. They graze outdoors. They graze on sort of, you know, salt-infused maritime herbs. They produce this beautiful cheese. But it's a question, once again, of asking where your food comes from. It's asking, you know, asking the questions. And, you know, we can very easily sort of rely on simple staples to provide the bulk of our calories, you know, legumes, that kind of thing. But make protein a treat, make farmhouse cheese a treat, and, you know, and seek it out and ask questions. And it all starts with asking the question that nobody asks anymore, because we're so alienated from the farm systems. And because we're alienated from farms and farmers, because we just don't encounter them anymore, it gets easy to make these arguments that we can replace all food production with synthesized protein. And that's not the answer. There's another deeper thing going on. There's the sort of indigenous approach to agriculture. And that was really interesting. I think indigenous people account for 5% of the population of the planet, but they occupy 20% of the land surface, and 80% of the biodiversity is there. And they developed systems of maintaining soil fertility that kept the soil fertile and kept the water clean for millennia in some cases, whereas a lot of the civilizations that we're more familiar with, like the Roman, for example, collapsed after a millennium because they exhausted their soil after 1,000 years. That happened with the Maya too, probably linked to a loss of, there was climate change, but also a loss of soil fertility. But there are these techniques like that I saw in Mexico City, the chinampas. These are what the Spanish called floating gardens, but there are these sort of raised bed horticultural systems that allow you to raise several crops, up to 8 crops of various vegetables and fruits and grains per year. So they're doing this in Bangladesh now, they're doing it in Poland, and they fed the ancient city of Mexico City, Tenochtitlan, which had a population of perhaps 1 million in the Valley of Mexico. It fed an urban population at that time. I like to look at things like that. There's also the Terra Preta of the Amazon, which is this incredibly fertile soil. And of course, the Amazon doesn't have fertile soil naturally. It's really nutrient poor. But by enriching the soil with human manure, with turtle shells, with pottery, that kind of thing, they created this soil where they could, you know, produce huge amounts of like calories in the jungle. It's still there, and people still gather it up and sell it as potting soil. There are examples like that all over the world, and it's often indigenous land management that, you know, produces the most sustainable form of agriculture. And I just don't understand why there's this whole tendency to like equate raising food with all of the evils of civilization. It's much more nuanced than that. And, you know, just asking the questions and going back into the history of what we eat, our love and quest for flavor, it really builds a useful counter argument to this harmful discourse, which is pointing us to this sort of, frankly, future that makes me despair. It kind of points to, you know, raising protein pancakes on Mars.
Keep in mind what you've just said, which is, in effect, you're making the argument not just for the recuperation of traditions from the ancient past, but actually traditions that exist now, but are being foreclosed, right, as people are being displaced. But I wanted to ask you about Roman cuisine. So going, you know, a fair amount back in time, Roman cuisine doesn't have a particularly good reputation. And I wonder why that is and why you think we should look beyond that anyway now.
Yeah, we associated it with like elite excess. The thing that really intrigued me, it was one of the first things, something I knew I had to do when I was researching this book, was this sort of Roman secret sauce called garum, also known as liquamen. It appears in almost all the existing ancient Roman recipes. So I learned that this team in the south of Spain, in Cadiz, was working with archaeologists who were working in Pompeii to recreate this sauce. They'd found amphorae on the site on this garum store that was buried in lava and ashes in Pompeii, and they recreated it using the remains they found in the amphorae, but also with recipes. And it was really interesting. It's basically made from sardines, but it was also made from bluefin tuna and even whales. It's the fish, or the mammals, I guess, sometimes were salted and reduced to this sort of liquid over the course of 3 months. They were obsessed with garum. It was kind of their way of adding salt to almost every dish they made. And interestingly enough, I worked with this archaeologist from Britain, Sally Granger. I kind of consider the Julia Child of ancient cookery. And she oversaw my own production of garum using Portuguese sardines. It's fantastic. It's a little similar to nuoc mam and nam pla, the Asian fish sauces, the same principle, but quite a different taste. It adds a very intense umami to a lot of dishes, and it existed in many different forms. It was made from, you know, mackerel, for example, which had a very intense flavor. There was a huge diversity of it, and they were obsessed with it. They find remains going from garum factories on the seashore, going from northern France all the way to Turkey. That for me was sort of the cornerstone of my Roman cookery. And once I had that, I assembled a pantry of different ingredients. They didn't have a lot, they had no New World spices, of course. There was a lot of pepper. And I'm not quite as decadent to say how I wasn't into cooking sow's wombs and eels and flamingos. There's ethical questions around flamingos these days. But what's interesting for me is that Roman cookery is quite different. It has nothing to do with modern Italian cooking. It's more like Cantonese. There's a sort of sweet and sour side to it. But because we can follow the recipes from this book called Apicius, you can really get close to what they must have been tasting. And it's a whole different world. It's a whole different sensorial world. Honestly, I was doing a lot of this during the pandemic, during lockdown, so I had the luxury of time. And it was a way of traveling. So you're not just leaving your country, you're kind of leaving your own, well, you're leaving the present and going back and encountering what people ate back then. And it's a brilliant way of time traveling. There's a guy called Seamus Blackley. I think he lives in the Bay Area, and he recreates Egyptian breads, among other things. He kind of sucks yeasts out of old pottery, it's in the storehouses and museums. And yeah, he said it's the same thing. It's a way of going back 2,000-3,000 years in the past entering the sensorial world of people who are no longer there, but, you know, who were just as smart and clever and good at problem solving as we were. So yeah, I maybe it's the closest thing we can get to time travel. It definitely opened my eyes.
Is it a coincidence that much of the reclamation of ancient foods or foods that are not new involves foods that are fermented?
Oh no, fermentation is such an awesome technique. It's like a bioprotective. It's a way of getting rid of pathogens. It's just, it became the cornerstone of my kitchen. I mean, if you go in my kitchen now, I've got my kefir going. I've got a SCOBY there. I've got, I'm constantly tending the sourdough, doing the kimchi, which I use garum, and I've experimented with all kinds of things. There's this guy called Sander Katz, who's just like the mastermind of fermentation. It is a fundamental, it's a form of cooking, right? It's a form of transformation of food, and it's a natural process. The one thing about fermentation that was really interesting for me is it taught me not to be afraid. The fermentation is such a robust process. The lactic acid bacteria are so good at getting rid of harmful bacteria. We've been made very afraid of this by sort of the industrial food system. You know, we're told, oh, well, you don't want to eat that. It's gone a little green. I learned not to fear these things and to trust my taste buds and my nostrils. And that's something we've lost. Because we were used to be, as a species, we've long been very good at detecting what is good for us and what is bad for us through smell, through odor, through appearance, that kind of thing. And the industrial food has disconnected us from that because they can simulate all of these flavors. They can trick us. I think we no longer trust ourselves, and that's a shame because those intense flavors were often a guide to the micronutrients that we need for good health. They say that you need to eat 30 different kinds of plant species per week to be sort of at optimum health. And most people, you know, are getting 4 or 5. If there's like one message from this book, one like dietary takeaway, it's like become a diversivore, someone who adds diversity to their diet. Try to get those 30 different kinds of plants in particular. That means you'll be getting the polyphenols, you'll be getting the antioxidants, you'll be getting the omega-3 fatty acids that are essential for good health, and that we used to use our noses and eyes and tongues to find. And now, you know, I mean, what can you do with a bag of Doritos? I mean, it tricks you into, it plays on all of your, you know, our love of fat and sugar and salt. But because that's sort of our fallback now, we've lost our way to navigate through the natural world. And for me, this was a process. I mean, I did some foraging in the book too, not something I'd recommend everybody in the world do. The world can't support 8 billion foragers, but it's an interesting process just to reawaken your connection to the natural world.
I'd like to end by asking you about the underlying system of food production. One of the complexities of our food system today is that while we do, of course, have vast monocultures producing, you know, single crops, the system is also compatible with bringing diverse and unheard of new foods to a niche, moneyed audience or consumers. And that is much a part of capitalist production, the production of ever new commodities, as are the monocultures. So in saying that for a sustainable future, we need to increase the diversity of what you eat, does that complexity unsettle you? And do you think there might be a way of managing that diversity in a food system that was more collective or was not based on profit?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, going back to the Romans, the first case of species extinction in recorded history, there were many before, driven by humans, was the disappearance of this plant called Sylphion, which was prized in ancient Rome, grew in North Africa. It was, this fennel-like plant with an incredible flavor. I actually went to central Turkey, and we think we've rediscovered it. But the risk is that global capitalism if there's this giant demand, can easily drive it to extinction again. So there's that whole risk, where, you know, demand and you know, the Romans were crazy about spices and all that, which they brought from around the known world at the time, but they were quite capable of, you know, driving things to extinction. There was a lot of costs associated with that and a lot of exploitation. So I do worry about that. I do think that you can get healthy diversity in local food webs. The best advice, the one that kind of I end the book with, is just like, you know, things what thinkers like Aldo Leopold and Wendell Berry said, you know, reconnect with food by, in whatever way you can, you know, even if it's like a, you know, a small pot garden on your back porch or growing your own herbs, just get back into the process of food production. You know, just try to do, you know, whatever. It's making your own yogurt, that kind of thing. What I loved about that was it's like you're sort of decolonizing and decapitalizing, deindustrializing your own kitchen. Like I said, I had the luxury of time during the pandemic to experiment with a lot of that. But wow, it just, you know, it increased diversity because I was seeking out all kinds of different ancient grains. Because I was doing it from scratch, the costs were a lot lower. But once again, it was a question of time. But I always wonder, like, time, like if you really get sensual pleasure out of flavor. You know, it seems to me a lot of us are like, this is the good life that all of us want. Why wouldn't we make time for that? You know, instead of just, you know, eating Soylent, which is like a meal substitute. That's the elimination of all pleasure and all joy. It just turns food into calories and fuel. You know, we figured all this out throughout our history. Without, you know, the benefit of whatever, higher education and all the science. We figured out how to feed ourselves. We can do it again. It's not a mystery. Well, it is a mystery. There are the small mysteries of fermentation, but they're lovely mysteries and they're life enriching.
Taras, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Sasha.
Taras Gresko is the author of 8 books, most recently, The Lost Supper, Searching for the Future of Food in the Flavors of the Past. And he writes at lostsupper.blog. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.